fresh eggs, I imagine.
Yeah.
Are they chicken laying eggs?
Good morning, or good afternoon, everyone. We're going to start our informational hearing that the House and Senate Committees on Judiciary are having this afternoon. These are informational meetings. I need to put on the record, looking at the agenda, the first presentation we had scheduled, which was dealing with constitutional issues concerning tort liability in Oregon, is being postponed for reasons that we have the House going back to the floor at 2, and so that will be rescheduled for next week, according to counsel. So what we're going to do is go in the following order. We'll first take informational hearing on Senate Bill 479, which is at the bottom of the agenda. We'll then go back up and pick up the Brady letters. And third will be House Bill 3087, dealing with fees for appeal on local land use decisions. So with that, we'll go ahead and open up an informational hearing on Senate Bill 479. And I believe we have Mary Abrams and Dave Honeycutt who are going to do the presentation for us today.
This is interesting.
Good afternoon.
Whoever would like to start, just give us your name and tell us your story.
Good afternoon, Chair Prozanski, members of the committee. My name for the record is Mary Abrams, and I'm the director of the Department of State Lands. I've come to present today on some of the activity that's been happening around Senate Bill 479, which was brought to the legislative session earlier this year, and it proposed to divest the state of its ownership interest in lands that had been filled, that had been created by filling state-owned waterways more than 50 years ago, 50 or more years ago. The department believes that this sort of an action would not be in the best interest of the state because of the value of some of these lands. However, this is a very long-standing issue, and it's one that we would really like to resolve. We'd like to develop a process that would allow interested parties to resolve the ownership question around these historically filled lands. To that end, and under the direction of the Senate Committee for Judiciary, we are going to be putting together a work group that would that will advise the department on a process that would allow us to, in a more timely and efficient manner, address these issues and come to conclusion. We recognize from the start that it's unlikely we would be able to resolve all of the issues, but if we could just get a majority of the lands at question resolved, that would be a huge step forward for everyone and decrease expenditures both for the state and also for the private landowners that are involved. However, because of the nature of the trust that is put in the state-owned lands to provide a number of public uses, recreation, commerce, navigation, and fisheries, it's important that we have a balanced committee work group that works on this. And so what we're proposing to do is to have a committee that would have equal representation from the landowners who are involved, representatives for the public trust values that have not been extinguished by the filling. Obviously, if a land is filled, there's no more navigation trust involved, navigation use involved. But for fisheries and recreation, there's still a possibility. The beneficiaries, the education beneficiaries that benefit from the trust that is given to the state to run the common school fund, and any sale, the proceeds from any of the sales of these properties would go into the common school fund, so it's important that the beneficiaries be at the table as it's some of their assets within the trust, and then some representation from the legislative body itself. I can stop there and take any questions that you have. I guess I should elaborate just a little bit more. We're proposing to start the work group in September. This will allow us to pull together a professional facilitator because these are very complicated and have been at times rather cantankerous issues, and we'd like to have a facilitator so that everyone can participate equally and fully in the conversations and discussions for the search for solutions. And then we would meet monthly for 5 months and then come back with a joint report both to the State Land Board, who is charged with the management of these lands, and also to the Legislative Committee. And with that, I'll be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
What we're going to do is go ahead and take Dave's testimony, then we'll open up the panel.
Okay.
So we can go back and forth.
Perfect.
Dave?
Chair Przanski, Chair Barker, members of the Joint Committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, here on the informational hearing on Senate Bill 479. This was a bill that Senator Cruz sponsored and that one of the first bills heard by the Senate Judiciary Committee. It deals with the issue of title to submerged and submersible lands that were at one time either underwater or at least sometimes partially underwater, and then were subsequently filled usually by dredge spoils when a port district dredge channel to widen a river for for commerce purposes. Those dredge spoils had to go somewhere, and typically were placed on submerged or submersible lands. And over the years, there have been title issues over who owns that property, and especially when a significant amount of time has passed and there's been some development proposals or development on the property. Situation came to light for us when we received a call from a property owner who owned land along Front Avenue that they had purchased downtown Portland, that they had paid $8 million for in 2006, I believe, and then in 2009 or 10, they received a letter from the Department of Justice indicating that the state was asserting an ownership interest in that property, and a follow-up letter indicating that the state's ownership interest could be purchased for $2.4 million. So essentially another $2.4 million on top of the $8 million that they had paid for the property. And of course, this came sort of out of the blue for them. They had no idea that there was a title issue. Unfortunately, this is a fairly broad problem. There's been a fair amount of research done on this issue over the years, and as I understand it, just along the Willamette River and the Oregon coast alone, there are 19,000 potential titles that are clouded as a result of this issue. So it's a problem that we would hope to seek some kind of solution for. When I first testified on the bill, and I thank you, Chair Przanski, for scheduling that bill for a hearing, I indicated that the bill was not yet ready for prime time. It obviously needed some further work, and the chair suggested that we bring this back in that we convene in the interim and try and figure out if there's a solution to this. I think that was a great idea. I still think that's a great idea. I thank Director Abrams for working on this, and am happy with the suggestion that we put together a group, come back, report jointly to the State Land Board, and also to the Judiciary Committee, either the Senate Judiciary Committee or both Judiciary Committees, on trying to find a solution to this. The one thing that I would encourage and hope for some direction from the chairs. In my experience, when there's a work group, the work group progresses farther along if there's some active involvement from the members themselves. And so to the extent, I know that there have been folks that have expressed interest, legislators that have expressed interest in working on this, to the extent that I can encourage you to encourage us to loop in some legislators to work on this, I would certainly hope that you would do that. So we stand willing to work and like this, and think that we may be able to make some headway on this long-standing problem.
Great, thank you. Question, Representative Krieger.
If you go back 50 years or before, clear back to the turn of the last century, 1800s coming forward, Coos Bay would be a good example. It was at the cost of somebody, not government or anything, that they went to the expense and engineering to put in the large docks, and then in many instances it wasn't dredgings that made that fill behind that, it was upland dirt that was brought down. So now you've created a lot of economic value And as property has gotten more expensive, do you think that the state should be compensated or charging based on what that property was without those benefits? Because they had no cost of incurring those benefits, doing the fill and the engineering and the riprap and all the things they do. And how do you equate that with today's market value of that land compared to when it was done, if it would have been transferred at the time?
Chair Pozanski, that is a question for me, I believe. Is that a question
either
for me?
Either way.
Okay. I would just say that that's an example of one of the issues that faces us in resolving these issues. We did in 2009, we had legislation that made an attempt to address that and laid out some criteria to consider in taking the current appraised value of property and discounting it based on a number of factors, including things like strength of ownership and past taxes paid, the access to the property, things like that. It has helped, I think it's safe to say, but it hasn't completely resolved the issue. And so what we'd like to do is take these very complicated cases and try and find a process that we can use to resolve them.
I would only say, Mr. Chair, that if you're going to resolve this type of thing, you have to have people on that work group that actually want to get to a conclusion that's acceptable and workable. You know what happens when one person's in there that is totally opposed. You just don't get there. So I think that's going to be crucial.
Thank you. Now, let's go with Senator Roblin and Senator Cruz.
Yeah, and I do appreciate the work that is being done now in trying to negotiate these very difficult settlements. My issue has always been that we've done this so piecemeal over the time, and the land board has gone on and off with respect to dealing with it. And so you have the 60s when they did the quick claim deeds for all of Astoria, so it solved a problem for the Astoria people. And then you've had issues in Coos Bay that you've worked out in negotiations, whether it was the tribes or whether it was the Downtown Business Association. So it appears to be very haphazard about it. And I think the latest trend has been whenever change of title happens, you try to make the decision at that time to go in and try to resolve it. And I think that's at least an attempt to get more systematic about how we approach these things. But I would really love to see a real solution that covers the whole thing in some way. When I saw the bill, I kind of enjoyed the idea of it, recognizing that I still do care about schools and the money that should have been there. And when at the turn of the in 1900, when we had a number of public officials selling off state land at fairly inexpensive prices to family and friends, there is a book and stuff about how bad that was. So I don't want to get in that same situation again, but I would love to get in a situation where people have a clear understanding that if they are going to buy some of this land, either before they buy it or whatever, they get to know what the issues are and they can have a conversation. Because it's always bad to find out after you've invested in something and you've allowed a negotiation to happen between two people who thought they had the right to do it, and then the one that ends up getting it finds out that they haven't really had any negotiations with the proper owner. I think that's inappropriate, and there should be some way of having a conversation ahead of time so you know that there's somehow we need to post this. And I know that in the 70s and 80s there were conversations about putting out a map that showed all of it, and I don't know that I've ever seen a comprehensive map of what it looks like, because even in Coos Bay I'd seen about 20 different maps indicating what was and what was originally filled, and then what was in dispute was much different than I had anticipated. I mean, I think most of us thought there'd be a lot more dispute in Coos Bay than it turned out to be, because we'd seen maps of ships docking to hotels on 7th Street. And so if that was all filled, that should have what happened in between. So it's kind of interesting. And I do think it would be good to get this resolved. And it has to be costing the land board a lot of money just to go through all these processes. So I think it would be to everybody's benefit that we actually come up with a solution that works across all these properties.
Senator Cruz?
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Chair, I want to thank you for making this an interim priority. Obviously, I have an interest in this as well. But, Mary, you were talking about the groups that need to be on there. Are you to the point of actually coming up with names of people yet who you want on the work group?
Chair Pozanski, Senator Cruz, we've started the conversation. I've been in touch with the affected landowner community representatives, I guess I would say, because obviously there's quite a few, and trying to work out the details about who would be best served. We're very anxious to have, it doesn't do us any good, as Representative Krieger notes, it doesn't do us any good to develop a process that's not going to help anybody. And so we really want to have the people at the table who are struggling with this issue, including the department, and Senator Roblin is correct, this does cost the department money, and we just assume not spend our money that way. So we're starting the process of identifying the people involved. I am open to guidance from the, you know, from the committee in terms of the legislative involvement. I know when we were here before, we discussed Senator Dingfelder. I have touched base with her, and she is interested. I think that Senator Roblin is another person who could bring a lot to the discussion just because of his historic knowledge. But I'm open to suggestions for what who from the legislative body would be best placed to help us out on this.
Ms. Chair, and in all due humble respect, this is my bill. I think I should be there. But
Chair Pozanski, Senator Cruz, I completely acknowledge that, and it was just one of the conversations that we had with the landowners was about different legislators who had had experience with this in the past. Right. So you're not disinvited whatsoever.
That's a good.
What farmers do landfills and stuff.
No, they don't. They don't do that. They don't even clean out ditches.
Hopeful caucus issue I can tell already.
Well, yeah. It is. Ms. Chair, it clearly is a coastal caucus issue.
It definitely is.
All right, any other questions, comments?
The alignment's just about as big.
I want to thank both of you coming forward. I know this may not seem like it's important, but for us, having this opportunity during the end of the session, we can start formulating ideas with committee staff to start putting together the perspectives of what we're going to try to work on. And so this helps us tee that up. So both of you, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we're going to go ahead and close the informational hearing on the Senate Bill 479, basically dealing with the state lands ownership. And open up our next informational hearing that's going to be on Brady letters. And this is, we have four individuals that are signed up to give us testimony or comments today. I'd like to maybe bring up a fourth chair, and that way we can have the four at the dais together. And so I have Daryl Gerritsen, Brian DeLashmet, Alex Gardner, and Kimberly Barnett. I think that's the four that I have.
Mr. Co-Chairs and members of the committee, if I may start, I'll be extremely brief. Brian DeLashmet, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations and the Oregon State Police Officers Association. The only reason I'm up here is to give you just a snippet, a minute or two, of what actually has transpired on this issue that you may not be aware of. I know that I talked to Bill Taylor earlier today over the last day or two, and up to that point, I think he was unaware of the progress and the working group that's already working on this issue. So there may not be any need for a legislative work group to be working. Prior to the election this last cycle, my clients actually had discussions with a number of folks, including the current Attorney General, and were asking for some kind of a process be put together so that we could have some statewide standards on Brady letters from one area to the other. And that actually has begun. I think it began independent of our discussions with the current Attorney General. Groups got together. That process is now happening with DPSST. We're at the table. I know the DAs are at the table, and a number of folks are at the table. So there is a process going on right now about Brady letters, and that's the reason why I wanted to explain where we're at as far as that process. And with that, I'll let Daryl talk.
Okay, thank you.
Do you want to start first?
No, go ahead.
Thank you, Co-Chairs. Daryl Gerritsen. I'm the attorney for the Oregon State Police Officers Association. The concern over Brady letters is that it affects the employment-employer relationship. And the other concern over Brady letters, besides the fact there's no standard, is there's also no consistency among the district attorneys as to how they handle a Brady situation. Some district attorneys will simply issue a letter that says, I believe this is a Brady officer and I'm not going to file any cases whatsoever.
You know, I just dawned on me, some of us up here may not know. I know exactly what we're talking about. But there, I think it'd work as to what a Brady letter does and what the impact actually is.
Goes back to a U.S. Supreme Court, Brady versus Maryland. It's basically an obligation of the prosecutor to provide information to the defense that either mitigates guilt or lessens sentences. It has been broadened through a variety of federal cases to include not only things that are admissible, but things that may lead to admissible evidence. The problem it's created then is the issue of the police officer's personnel file. Does the district attorney have an obligation to research the personnel file, and then does he have an obligation to disclose? So that's where it ends up impacting the employment relationship. Probably a classic example, and I'm not going to name the officer, but there was a case where an officer was investigated. The district attorney in that particular county chose to issue a Brady letter where he said, I won't prosecute any cases where this officer is involved. That officer was terminated. It went to arbitration. The arbitrator found that the investigation was so flawed that the employer had no justification to discipline the employee and ordered him fully reinstated. The problem is that jurisdiction now has an officer that the county won't file on, but under the employment-employer relationship, the employer can't take any further action. And the concern from the union side, obviously, is an arbitrator is a neutral. That's somebody who actually is unbiased and has an opportunity to look at it. And there is no process with the DA either to have input into the particular district attorney that chooses to issue a Brady letter or even an opportunity to appear or discuss. Now, some DAs actually do invite the officer in and have conversation. Other DAs have just simply issued a letter. The third thing that happens is some DAs just simply say, okay, you're a Brady officer. Any case you're involved in, I'm going to notify the defense, and you're going to get cross-examined over it. So you better be prepared to deal with whatever it is in your personnel packet that is likely to lead to some sort of cross-examination.
Okay, thank you for the explanation. I'm looking at the clock because I do know House members are going to need to be leaving. So let's go ahead and get the testimony if we can, or the statements from others, and then we'll open up the panel for questions.
Thank you, Chair.
Go ahead. Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Alex Gardner, and I'm the Lane County DA. I can tell you how this got to DPSST because I'm on the board, and I'm the one that wrote the letter to Director Gablix and asked him to help us put together a work group to talk about these things. There are two separate issues that tend to get blurred into the so-called Brady discussion. One is just what you just heard about, where there's evidence of some misconduct which would tend to impeach the officer, and we have a duty to disclose that to the defense. Part of the reason for some inconsistency around the state is that may be more or less damning evidence. I mean, if it's a minor incident involving the officer, that would be easy to sort of work through at trial without destroying the officer's testimony, that's one thing. If it's a situation in which the entire command staff at the police agency and all the officers' peers would describe the guy as a liar, he is essentially worthless as a witness. So that, depending on where the case is or the officer is on that continuum, defines how the case is processed. A completely separate matter is whether the DA involved thinks the officer is not a reliable witness. That's irrespective of what the agency might think or what Brady evidence there might be. If the DA believes that he cannot or she cannot rely upon that officer in one witness's word against another situation to carry the case beyond reasonable doubt, that officer is not going to be called because the DA has a duty to justice, and if the DA doesn't believe this person, he's obviously can't call that person as a witness. Last year, I sent Director Gablix a letter and said, could we please address this, because I had a number of these cases. One of the challenges is that when the case is brought to an arbiter, the arbiter, in my experience, and I've worked a bunch of these now, and I've testified at arbitrations, they don't necessarily understand the difference between a police officer and anybody else in the employment world. There are lots of jobs that somebody can do effectively with maybe even a reputation as a liar, but police officer is not among them. And so we have had officers reinstated where they clearly could not function in the job. But then, of course, the DA still can't call them as a witness, and so the person is worthless. And at least in one case, although the arbiter reversed the termination, the agency was willing to pay whatever it took to get rid of that officer and move forward because he couldn't do anything. We've had one meeting at DPSST. We have another one scheduled. We are broken into work groups. The work groups include leadership from OSP, sheriffs, chiefs association, labor is present as indicated. We have USDOJ and the Oregon AG's office there, all by invitation, and I'm hopeful that we'll be able to come up with something. We all would like to have a more unified, uniform process across the state. Ultimately, there are some situations which are going to distill to the DA's ability to call this witness in good conscience. And so we're not going to be able to have every case processed in a uniform way because every case is different. But we should have guidelines.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Kimberly Barnett, and the reason I'm here is because I'm married to a police officer. At one time, I had a job with the City of Salem where I acted as a liaison between the community and the police department and became involved in various interests that the police department had, policies such as burglar alarm and that kind of thing. Later, I ended up marrying a police officer. This issue, Brady issue, came to light to my attention the first of this year, and what I have come to realize or find out is that when a district attorney decides that they want to issue a Brady letter, which is a career-ending event for a police officer, because as you've heard, if an officer is deemed to be untruthful, they can't do their job, they're useless. The DA does not have to provide any information to the officer as to any details as to why. There is no due process in this case. This is the gap in Oregon law, and this is why I came to Senator Cruz and Senator Prezansky and Senator Courtney, because the officers need to know. They need to have reports of an investigation that may have been done. You've heard about an officer who was terminated and then through arbitration was found out that the investigation that was done on an officer was lacking. And that can happen. I can give you two examples of two officers. Officer A was having a conversation with a deputy district attorney. It was just a casual conversation about an arrest he made, and during incident to that arrest he seized some drugs. The DDA wanted to know when was the timing that he tested those drugs. I'm sure you've all seen on TV here where they have little chemicals, they put the drugs in, shake it, turns a certain color, and that's how the officer knows for a fact that he's got meth or cocaine or whatever. Well, the officer did not have his reports with him because it was just a conversation and said, I can't remember. The DDA decided, based on that conversation, that this officer was now untruthful and threatened a Brady letter against this officer. Officer B, after years of no contact with people he had personal relationship with at one time, suddenly these people have come forward and filed a complaint against him that has nothing to do with his job, nothing to do with truthfulness. An investigation was launched. It was an incomplete investigation, and the DA's office issued a Brady letter. The officer has seen no reports, was given no details as to why. When this happens, there's a ripple effect, because it's not just an isolated person in uniform that this affects. It affects their entire families. It affects the agency. If the officer has done nothing wrong and the agency knows it and the agency he works for is supportive and keeps him in the agency doing something other than police work, they're having to pay him. And they lose an officer on the street. And then there's no recourse for the officer. There's no appeals process. Once a DA makes this decision in the state of Oregon, that's it. There's nowhere for the officer to go. That's why we need to implement due process in this situation, because if it's not the agency the officer is employed by who takes action against the officer, it's the district attorney's office, and then that hamstrings the agency and the officer, but the officer doesn't work for the DA's office. So there's no administrative due process, there's no appeals process, there's nothing that they can do, and they're provided no information or no detailed information as to what's happening.
Ms. Barnett, thank you very much. What I'm going to do is see if there's any questions. I'm going to make some comments after that. Are there any questions? Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, so I'm not actually a prosecutor, I see a few in the audience, and I'll perhaps direct this at you, sir. Thank you guys for coming in. But it seems to me, Grant, given that law enforcement and the district attorney's office typically work hand in hand, that when a DA issues a Brady letter against essentially what is a colleague, I would think that's a relatively extraordinary act that's generally not done in a cavalier way. Although it undoubtedly seems arbitrary, perhaps, from a different point of view. Can you comment on that? What kind of, I mean, is this done often? Can you talk about that?
Representative Barton, Chair Przanski, it is not done often. Lane County's a fairly large jurisdiction, and I think we've seen maybe four of these in the last 10 years. They're more common than they used to be because things are changing in the law enforcement culture. And so if you go back 20 years and you ask any new cop, one of the first things that the FTO, the field training officer, tells the cop is you can make almost any mistake. The one thing you cannot do is lie. That's a career-ending deal. And that used to be true. And what we now see is that from time to time, even when somebody is caught in a lie with the chief, for example, one of my cases involved somebody who lied about the disposition of evidence and was caught. There was no disagreement about what happened. Ultimately, the defense, by the way, in that case, that the arbiter agreed with, is that the officer was so distraught from his divorce, which preceded this incident by 18 months, that he wasn't aware he was lying at the time. The other cops didn't believe it, the chief didn't believe it, and so there was a Brady determination. And in that, if you wound the clock back 20 years, that guy would have been terminated. There would have been no letter. But the culture has changed. Everything is litigated now, and so the burden has shifted to the DA's office, and we're having to answer this in situations that we never would have seen.
May I ask a follow-up, please?
You may.
Thank you for that. I'm going to ask you to kind of, I guess, answer what might be a hard question off the top of your head. I'm sorry I didn't give you any notice about this, but it seems to me, on one hand, I really can understand from the cop's perspective, there's this career-ending letter issued. There doesn't seem to be any due process or recourse, or you can't appeal it necessarily. On the other hand, let's pretend there were a due process system in place of, say, administrative procedure. The rules of professional responsibility still impose that duty on the district attorney, or at least so I would think. How are we going to reconcile those two things, if they can be reconciled?
Representative Barton, Chair Przanski, the bottom line is, regardless of what the system determines, I can't possibly call a witness that I don't believe.
I would think not.
So that's the bottom line. We can't legislate elected officials to do that.
Let me do this. I'm going to get ready to lose our representatives because they're going to have to go back to the floor. We have one other issue. I want to thank you for coming forward. I know this was not a full-fledged, and it was not intended to be a full-fledged hearing, but really to kind of scope the project. What we do know at this point is that there is something working through DPSST, and I think it's important. I'll have Mr. Taylor monitor that for the Senate Judiciary Committee, and I guess Representative Barker is fine with that as well. And we'll figure out where we're at and what, if anything, we will need to do. Realize during your work group that the legislature is here to assist, and if there is some stuff we need to do legislatively based on that work group, we'll be more willing to entertain that work.
Mr. Chairman, and I would say, and I've become familiar with this, obviously, if this work group can solve the problem, that's better than us doing it.
Understood.
Yeah. All right.
After
thank you.
36 years in the building. Understood.
Yeah. Thank you very much. On this one? Okay. We have a request on our last one. We only have like 8 minutes, and because everything's getting rushed, they would like to come back. So I think what I'm going to do, unless committee members want to have some discussion on the third topic now, since the presenters are willing to come back and have the discussion at another time, we'll set up for, well, I got a couple of people with their hands up in the air like, what's going on? Okay, so why don't we do this? Some of y'all want to go forward? We'll let you go forward. So I'm going to go ahead and open up.
Sorry. We have some people from.
So why don't we go ahead and open up an informational hearing on House Bill 3087. It's not the intent of the chairs to keep anyone from testifying, but what we can do is we can scope it, and if we need to continue it, we'll continue it next week. So I got Jonathan Manton, and then I got a representative from AOC and one from the League.
So you drove down for a while? Yeah. Would you like to go first?
No, that's fine. Okay.
Well, thank you, then, Mr. Chair. I guess I'll go first really fast and just offer that you know, I could come back next week and we could talk about this further. Would probably be my preference, because this is a longer conversation than 4 minutes, certainly, to explain this. But
you know, the purpose today is basically kind of scope the issue, to give members in law opportunity to understand what it is, and then we're going to be looking at it more so in a more fine defined process. So if you see members leaving, it's not because they don't like what you're hearing. It's just because they got to get to the floor.
Or a combination of both.
Yeah. That was obvious. Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chairman of the committee. My name is Jonathan Manton on behalf of Central Oregon Land Watch. I'll try to just lay out, you know, very, very quickly what the issue here is we're talking about, and that's what's called local government appeal fees. And the first step in a planning process at the land use level is an applicant will submit their proposal to the county or city. By statute, the amount that can be charged by the city or county before a hearings officer or a planning commission is $250. For either side to then appeal that decision to the full board of county commissioners or to the city council, there is currently no quantitative limit on what can be charged for that appeal fee. And the document that I've been given, that I've provided for you, shows the widely discrepant amount of fees charged by individual counties and cities. Most are $250, most are $400. The overwhelming, you know, percentage of cities and counties don't charge an exorbitant rate for that appeal fee. However, a handful do. It's over $11,000 in one instance in Klamath County. Some of the Central Oregon counties are well over $2,000 and $3,000. So you just have an access to justice issue where community groups can't afford to pay the amount that it would cost them to present their case to the county commissioners. It's basically a pay-to-play system that only a few cities and counties are charging exorbitant rates on. The counties are limited to the actual cost, and so the dynamic that we have here is that you have cities and counties, in some instances, are able to charge the appellant whatever they can justify as the actual cost of that hearing. If they're hiring expensive attorneys, then they could basically, it's just the lower level appellant has to pay to play for their own access to the court system. So the solution that we proposed, which I was hoping to talk to you a little further about, maybe at another time, and what that would actually do, and it would not bankrupt the counties. It would give them the discretion to either put a cap on the amount they could charge for the fee, or then they could allow the lower level ruling of the hearings officer to move forward as their final order. So it wouldn't actually impose a financial hardship on the cities and counties. It would give them discretion to handle it as their budget allows. But again, would love to have a longer conversation about that, and thank you for the opportunity to be before you today.
Mike?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mike Eliason from the Association of Oregon Counties. I'll be very brief in the interest of time. I would submit, and I appreciate Mr. Manton's testimony, I'd submit that one of the biggest reasons for the disparity in land use fees, appeal fees around the state, at least with respect to counties, is frankly to the degree that the general or the county board is willing to subsidize the cost. So you might find in one county they've made a decision to charge for example $250 or $300 for an appeal to the full board. In another county they may have made a decision that frankly their general fund is thin, and when they are divvying up their resources amongst sheriff's department, community corrections, public health, mental health, et cetera, that they, other departments need to be essentially fee-driven. In some cases, it's the planning department for land use fees. So for example, Multnomah County may charge $250 across the board, but when you look, when you open up the books and look at the cost that they're putting into it, they're actually choosing to subsidize a lot of that cost. Some counties simply can't do that. Now, with respect to, as the first time I heard the Mr. Manton's suggestion around making the staff level or hearings officer decision the final decision, one issue with that for counties are that if that is the final order of the county and it's subsequently appealed, right now the elected officials, a decision by the board or elected official is entitled to deference at LUBA and the Court of Appeals. A staff level or hearings officer decision is not. So there are some issues wrapped up in that. We certainly are willing to show or have a deeper discussion on how we get to where we get with some of those fees if it's determined or if in certain parties' perspective it's exorbitant. Certainly want to sit down and explain why in some cases the charge is what it is, but I'll leave it at that for now.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Kirby. I'm city attorney for City of Beaverton, and I think I'll just echo what's been said here. The one thing I would point out is that there is a variety of ways that different jurisdictions handle this issue, and it's going to be a difficult situation to deal with on a one-size-fits-all. Beaverton, for example, is an agency that has a decent general fund. We subsidize quite a bit out of our fees. We do charge greater fees than $250 on the more complicated issues, but it is in Beaverton's situation, it's a bit of a hybrid. We do try to recover some of the costs, but we're not 100% cost recovery, as I understand some counties are. And you have 36 counties to deal with, but you have scores of cities to deal with, and it's going to be a difficult problem to solve. I understand the problem of overreaching and having exorbitant fees, access to judgments, a legitimate concern, but also a healthy general fund is a legitimate concern. So that's the tension that I see, and it may not be something that's a one-size-fits-all sort of a solution.
Thank you. Any questions for anyone on the panel?
Mr. Chair, I'd just point out on the list they gave, there's nothing for Curry County, and that's basically because they no longer exist.
Mr. Chair, I want to make sure Deschutes County, actually, they've been a part of this discussion in the past, and they really wanted to participate today, can't. So I just wanted to put on the record that if anything goes forward in terms of a work group, Deschutes County planning staff or their, you know, board, somebody from Deschutes County would love to be involved in some way.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you for dropping down. And that concludes our work for today, so we'll close the informational hearings.